Thank you, folks. Have a seat. Give me just a moment to change something. All right, this is the time set for oral argument in Brian Houston v. Paul Pinzon et al. Case number 1CACV 250511. Counsel, let me say first, welcome. Appreciate you being here. Welcome to those in the gallery as well. We're always excited to have folks here and observe, and so welcome all of you. You have 20 minutes per side. You don't need to use it all. Use the time that you feel you need. Counsel, if you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, you're welcome to tell us, but we're not going to guard it for you. If we happen to notice, we may say you're cutting into it, but otherwise it's going to be on you. The clocks are on the podium for you to watch. The proceedings are being recorded. They're being audio and video recorded and live streamed. For that reason, we do ask that you state your name and the party you represent before you begin to argue. That way people at home and in the gallery here today even know who you're here for and who you're representing. Keep in mind, counsel, we have read the briefs. We've conferenced the case and have talked about it extensively this morning. So you don't need to repeat the briefs. Please focus on what you think is critical that we focus on here today as we're working on this resolution of this matter. With that, counsel, you're welcome to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is William Ladnier on behalf of the appellant plaintiff, Brian Houston, and the proposed class. I'd like to reserve a portion of my time for rebuttal, and may it please the court. This case, as the court is well aware, centers on the uniform policy of Maricopa County to publish the mugshots and personal information of those individuals arrested within the county. This occurs shortly after arrest, and it publishes information on the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office website for a period of 3 days, and that information includes the mugshot photograph, the quote-unquote crime type, and other personal information. Notably, it does not include any sort of disclaimer regarding the presumption of innocence that all individuals under the foundational principles of this republic have when arrested. It includes no information at all that they have not been adjudicated, that the evidence of the charges for which they were arrested have been reviewed by a prosecutor, much less a judge.
Counsel, would it make a difference if it had? I'm not sure why that matters.
We think that that point is pivotal to the claims at issue. I was trying to think of the possible best way to explain this, and the way I came up with was, obviously the claims that plaintiff Brian Houston is bringing, both individually and on behalf of class members, is for the tort of false light. So putting aside the class nature of the claims here, think of it as if he were just an individual, and he was only bringing a claim for defamation or false light. That would require him to show that there was publication of information, that it be either true or false, and if true, that it created an implication regarding that was false or regarding his private life, and that implication be highly offensive to the reasonable person. Now,
so no reasonable person could be offended, perhaps, if they had put the disclaimer up?
Yeah, I think we would agree with that. I think we would agree with that, yes. Mm-hmm. Because the claim that Brian Houston is making is that following his arrest, that he and every other individual in the class, their mugshot was posted and their personal information was posted, and that created the implication that they were guilty, that they were a criminal. That's because mugshots under the case law of this state and nationwide are highly prejudicial. It's been found that they create this sort of implication of guilt, that the person is a criminal. It is a bit ironic that under the law of this state and elsewhere, that when these individuals are tried, that their mugshots would be considered so prejudicial that they wouldn't be allowed to be shown at the trial, that the term mugshot under the case law of this state is considered so prejudicial because it includes...
So, counsel, I'm going to interrupt you a little bit because I understand exactly what you're saying and what you're getting at. I think my trouble in listening to you is these sound like a lot of policy arguments that I'm hearing. Like, exactly what... I want to hear more about the law and how we are specifically not able to uphold the Superior Court's order denying class certification. That's really what I'm interested in hearing. So I get all of your policy arguments, but that's what I'm hearing you say, and I want to be focused more on the law and how your client and this class fits within the false light piece, and the class can be represented under false light.
I'm happy to address that. I will say respectfully, I think we disagree that these are necessarily policy issues only. We think that if anything, these are policies that are created from the case law, from Godby here, from Briscoe, from other cases. But to address the class certification itself, class certification is, Rule 23 creates a mechanism for courts in terms of judicial efficiency and manageability and the protection of absent class members' claims to allow the adjudication on a mass scale for claims that are alike. Here, all of the class members bring the same claim as Brian Houston, that their mugshots were published by defendants for a period of 3 days following their arrest, and that that publication did not include any sort of disclaimer of the presumption of innocence, that the implication of that publication was that they were criminals and that they were guilty, and that as a result of that implication, they suffered reputational harm. Now, all
so
of this...
Counsel, and there's a reasonable person in here wandering through this. So they were arrested, their mugshot taken, they pled guilty, or they were convicted. Not so reasonable to be offended anymore, right? Because it's the... I mean, we start with these are... You're not saying he wasn't in fact arrested, it wasn't his picture. You know, that would be the untrue statement. We've got a true statement. These people, we assume, were arrested and they were booked. They were charged with whatever. The information is true. So then would a reasonable person really be offended at this? Well, isn't your class at best just the people who didn't eventually get convicted?
No, that's respectfully, that's not correct. So I think that one way that we presented it to the trial court and one way that this court can think of it is that there may be two distinct subclasses within the set, with the overarching class of the overarching class being all those people that were arrested and had their information published on the website. But within that, there can be two subclasses. One of those people that were convicted and adjudicated as guilty, and the other, those that weren't adjudicated as guilty, whether their charges were dropped, like plaintiff Brian Houston, whether they entered a no contest plea, anything of that sort. Those can be separated. That's a manageability question under Rule 23. That can be addressed. But going back to your question, and I want to go back to my previous answer, I think it's best to put aside the class nature of the claims here and just look if, just for a moment, to think of it as just plaintiff Brian Houston bringing only his claim. He's bringing a claim either for defamation or for false light. The crux of that claim regards the publication of information. The harm itself that underlies the claim arises from the publication. The injury accrues when that information is published. So going back to this case, it accrues, that injury accrues for plaintiff Brian Houston and for every class member as soon as their mugshot and personal information is posted on the MCSO website.
I want to stop you right there because you're presuming that there is an injury at that point for every single person. Is that fair to summarize your argument?
I think that's a fair summary. I will qualify it a bit by saying I don't think we're presuming. We feel very strongly that there is an injury, but yes.
Fair enough. And obviously this claim, as adopted by our Supreme Court in God Be Here, arises out of Section 652E of the restatement. So that's what I turned to. I was a little bit surprised to not see in either party's briefing any discussion of comment C, which expands on what it means to be highly offensive to a reasonable person, which is one of under subsection A of 652E. And what really drew my attention is in comment C, it describes what is highly offensive to a reasonable person. And what the restatement says is, and I'm quoting here, the very last sentence of the comment, it is only when there is such a major misrepresentation of his character, history, activities, or beliefs that serious offense may reasonably be expected to be taken by a reasonable man in his position that there is a cause of action for invasion of privacy. The use of his there instead of a suggests to me that those are plaintiff-specific details that we need to look to determine whether there was, whether it's a particular statement that was made, true or not, is highly offensive, requires looking at plaintiff-specific facts in terms of the plaintiff's character, beliefs, opinions, et cetera, and then to determine whether the statement would be highly offensive to a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position. That suggests to me plaintiff-specific facts in two different ways. How am I wrong about that?
So respectfully, I would disagree with that interpretation in the sense that there, I would assume that there are many comments throughout the statute and other subsections of the statute that have the same language. But that doesn't mean that that specific comment and the choice of language necessarily precludes class certification. The class action device under Rule 23 is to allow the adjudication of claims that are alike when they arise from a uniform pattern of conduct. And that's exactly what we have here. Now, those I think tie into the merits questions, but I think the common questions here are, was it highly offensive to a reasonable person based on an objective standard? Now, that common question, based on the proof that will be developed, can be answered all at once. And that is all that commonality, Rule 23B, requires.
So we should just ignore that sentence then and the specifics about the reasonable person in the plaintiff's position? Like those are irrelevant and that's an error?
I don't think that it's necessarily irrelevant, but I think that those common questions will be answered all at once. And that is exactly what the case law in Walmart v. Dukes requires. Now, certainly, the answer to that question could be that we lose on the merits. But that would mean that we lose on the merits for the class as a whole. The central question under Rule 23 is, are the merits of the claims necessary? Like, would the merits of the claims be ruined under a reading of that statute? But given the uniform policy and the uniform conduct that affected all class members, the answer to that question would apply to all of them.
This is where I want to push back again here, because I don't know anything of your clients, of Mr. Houston's history, where his place in the community, but do you think that for purposes of the false light claim, a person with a very long criminal record, a history of violence, an order of protection against them, whose photo appears on the sheriff's website and who is ultimately convicted of this crime, would be similarly situated to someone who's a pastor, who serves on community boards, you know, is a model citizen otherwise, who is wrongfully accused of a crime and whose photo appears on there and they're never actually convicted? And those people suffered the same injury at the same exact time necessarily, is the crux of your argument?
Yes, I think that they suffered the same harm. That is, they suffered reputational harm. Now, the degree to which they suffered it, that is, how their damages are measured, the amount of those damages, would certainly be different. Or they could be different. I suppose we would have to require some fact-finding on that. But the bottom line is, the case law is very clear differentiations and variations in the amount of damages does not preclude certification.
So, counsel, let me ask you this, because false light claims have been around for quite a while, right?
Absolutely.
So have class actions, right?
Yes.
Any case that says, that's just yes or no, a case that says false light claim can be subject to class cert?
No.
Okay, so now let me, what's the closest case you can give us to support your argument here today that the false light claim is analogous to and would fit class certification? Because that's, I struggle with how false light gets into that class cert. So if you can give me a case to look at, you say, gosh, this is the one that doesn't.
So I think it's the Parsons case, which is, I believe, out of Arizona. That was a case involving detainees. And roughly the facts of that case were such that when certain detainees in the prison were separated out, they were given insufficient nutritional food and essentially defendants raised the same arguments under those factual circumstances, very similar to those that they are doing here, that certification cannot possibly be allowed under those circumstances because every single person is going to get different nutritional value from the food that they're given, that they're going to have different dietary needs. And the court said, no, that absolutely does not matter. That may go to the degree of harm that each person suffered. It may go to the varying degrees of damages that are awarded to each class member, but it doesn't preclude class certification.
So let me pick at that a little.
Absolutely.
Insufficient food, regardless of your dietary ability or not, whatever, is a harm. Agree?
Yes.
Putting my picture up on a website is not inherently the same. It's a picture. Your harm has to go a step further than the food and not having enough food, because you have to then get to, it's not just the photo, it's got to be the photo in this context made them be embarrassed or affected them. So I don't quite see it at the same level. So tell me why it is.
Well, I think that the premise of your question goes to the problems of the record below, because we believe that we can certainly provide a manageable way of measuring class-wide damages to not only establish the liability that every single person suffered reputational harm, but provide a way to measure on a class-wide basis that harm for every class member.
Which is interesting, because one of the things in Parsons was they weren't seeking damages. They wanted injunctive relief. That's not what you're asking for here.
We did.
Want to get something different, which would be, in that case, if they had asked, and we want to make sure that every single person has an absolutely adequate meal, so we're going to look at every single person's diet, that would make it analogous. If you were just here to say, please take them off the website, which I believe since 2024 they've been off, am I right?
Yes, okay. We did originally claim injunctive relief. They then took it down, but now it's back up with notably a disclaimer of innocence, which we think necessarily kind of proves our point as to the harm that arises at the point that it's published.
I don't know how subsequent remedial measures work in this kind of claim, but okay.
But putting that aside, we still think that that is very analogous. Again, going back to, it, if anything, the Parsons case stands for this proposition that the individual circumstances, and that's the exact sort of terminology and individualized, quote-unquote, individualized inquiries that defendants raised and that the trial court latched onto, we believe, in error, when it found that necessarily there were going to be too many sort of individualized, fact-driven inquiries for each class member. We disagree with that. But if anything, that finding by the trial court absolutely shows that there has to be class discovery. We believe that this court should reverse and remand with an order that class discovery be taken, that we then be able to renew our motion based on the factual evidence before the trial court.
Let me ask you about the discovery question.
Absolutely.
You filed your Rule 23 motion after the motion to dismiss was resolved, I think before an answer was even filed, and before you availed yourselves of any of the discovery tools under the rules of civil procedure. As I read the record, a request for discovery or a mention of discovery didn't come up until your reply brief on the Rule 23 motion, and I think it was in a footnote. And now we've got arguments here that the trial court erred by denying you discovery. That seems pretty bold to be saying that that was trial court error. Why didn't you seek discovery before filing the certification motion, and why should we remand with instructions to allow for discovery?
Simply put, from the hearing on the motion to dismiss, our interpretation from what the trial court was telling us was that he wanted this case to move expeditiously. And we believed, and we still believe, that based on the complaint and the pleadings and the factual evidence that is already in the record from the complaint, at the very least, that there is proof enough that class certification is proper here, given the uniform policy, the uniform way that this was posted and impacted everyone. But given the arguments that were raised by defendants in their response brief, where they said, no, this is a fact-intensive inquiry that's going to require individualized evidence, we had to respond to that and say, look, if the court is going to say and agree with those assertions based on absolutely no facts presented, that's fine. The court can do that, but at a minimum, we would ask that the court deny without prejudice and allow us to develop the factual record. That's why when those arguments were really pushed in the hearing, we asked that the court do just that. And that's why we think, given the language of the court's order that relied on that those fact-driven inquiries, I believe my time's up, if I could finish.
Very quickly.
That the court should have denied without prejudice, and that's why we ask that this be reversed and remanded on those grounds. It's a very simple solution to this appeal. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, so counsel, you figured you could hear what is spoken up. We'll add a minute and a half to your time, and I'll give you a minute and a half for rebuttal because I know you were trying to, and we had one last question for you, which was an important question. So, counsel, if you just wait till we get the clock set, and then whether you need them or not, you'll have an extra minute and a half.
Just to point out, they're putting it on the wrong side.
No,
it's on Appley.
It's on Appley.
You were giving him an additional amount of time.
I'm giving you an additional minute and a half also.
I apologize. I misunderstood. I misunderstood that.
It's something they talked to me about when I got appointed.
I'll take it.
And then we'll do the same for him. And counsel, you can start while we get the other clock set.
Good afternoon, I think now, Your Honors. Sarah Barnes for the appellees, Maricopa County and the current sheriff, Sheriff Sheridan. And may it please the court, I want to first jump right in to what Your Honor Judge Gaona pointed out, and you raised it by reference to the restatement section 652E, comment C. And while I understand the concern that neither side cited it, we did point out and relied on the trial court's explanation of those important factors of a false light invasion of privacy tort, which is something that appellants have just frankly ignored. They're ignoring the fact that there's more to proving this claim than just saying there was a publication and it didn't have a disclaimer, and so that automatically means liability is established under a false light invasion of privacy tort, which is simply incorrect, and they don't cite any authority for that proposition. And in fact, if that were accurate, there wouldn't be any need for a trial here, right? It would just go, let's just go straight to, you know, a bifurcated situation of just trying to prove damages for each individual if it was a putative class. And in fact, the reason why the trial judge pointed out that there can't be class certification here is because all of the determinations that need to be made to establish not only damages but liability for a false light invasion of privacy tort require an individualized analysis as to every potential plaintiff. And again, as Judge Gaona pointed out, that goes to that particular plaintiff. So while appellants talks repeatedly about it being clear error because this is an objective standard and it's established and it doesn't need an individualized inquiry, that's not accurate. The reasonable person determination is going to be based on how they would feel if they would be highly offended in that person's shoes, based on that person's history, based on that person's characteristics, how offensive the publication is. For example, if you have somebody who has an incredible history of felonies, violent conduct, et cetera, and then they are arrested and their mugshot is posted for a shoplifting or failure to appear on a bunch of tickets, for example, those things need to come into play to determine whether or not a reasonable person would be highly offended in that plaintiff's shoes. We can't get rid of the shoes. The shoes are important. It's that person's shoes. And
it's not just embarrassed.
Correct.
I mean, that's part of it. I mean, we could even say, look, we probably anyone whose mugshot goes up, not everyone, I've been around long enough to know, might be embarrassed by that. But it's not, you have to show more than that. And they seem to be arguing, as long as we can say, oh, it was probably embarrassed, that's enough because there wasn't a disclaimer.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The appellees 100% agree with that position, and it was the same position that the trial court took below.
Why is this case not like Parsons? That's the one that he said is the closest to his case, and I suspect I was quite articulate at trying to tease it out. So you tell me why it doesn't matter.
I thought you were very articulate, Judge Goss, on that point.
Not at all.
But I will add whatever further clarification I think that I can, which is it's not analogous in many respects. First, it is a class action in which they were only seeking injunctive relief, one. Two, it's a Monell policy claim, right? It's about whether or not there was a policy in place that was the motivating factor behind unconstitutional conditions of confinement, medical care, diet, those sorts of things. Those don't require any sort of individualized analysis. Now, whether or not there would be damages if it had been a damage case, there might be a difference in who was affected in what way, right? But that's not the case that Parsons was dealing with.
So we do have a policy. I mean, let's start with that. So there's a policy to post these photos. There's a policy with regard to how people are fed. Then the allegation is, and that a reasonable person in each individual's situation would be offended versus people aren't getting... We're denying their constitutional right to the food they're entitled to, and that's an unconstitutional. How are those two pieces different, that second two?
They're different because the policy is the crucial driving point of the claim in the Parsons case. The policy here is not. Whether there's been a false invasion of privacy such that there is an actual injury and damage to any one of the tens of thousands of people that they're proposing make up this class, that it doesn't matter what the policy or justification was behind the publication of the mugshots. Nobody disputes that it said crime tight. There isn't a dispute that mugshots were posted on this site for the period of time that they were posted. There's not a dispute that there wasn't a disclaimer during the relevant time frame. Whatever the
constitutional right to not have your photo posted.
There is not a
But if you're a prisoner in a prison, there is a constitutional right to not be mistreated, to be fed. You know, those kinds of things are constitutional rights.
That's absolutely true, and that's a constitutional claim, a deliberate indifference claim, various aspects of a deliberate indifference claim in the Parsons case. That is not the case here. We're talking about a false invasion of privacy tort, not a constitutional right, and again, the real difference is, besides the injunctive relief versus damages, is that the policy aspect in Parsons is what drives the liability determination. That is not the case here.
I want to follow up on a question that Judge Goss asked your friend on the other side, which is about case law. I believe in your brief you identified the TAG case from a federal district court. That may be the only case that you found that dealt with this in terms of trying to deal with class certification and a false light claim. I didn't find anything else. Are you aware of any other cases?
That was the closest one that we could find. And of course, we're happy to have found it because we believe that it is supportive of our position on this appeal and below for that matter. But yes, the Southern District of Florida case from 2022, where you have these individuals are surveilled and videoed and then arrested. And in that particular instance, that gentleman was found, they didn't pursue the charges, but we believe that court's determination that those kinds of damages have to be done on an individualized basis, and it is It is simply the exact type of claim analysis here for all the reasons that Your Honor pointed out, Judge Gayona, which is all of the things relevant to that person, their character, their history, the position in which they operate as far as their career or viewed by society, what have you. All of those individualized factors, and they're bullet pointed by, you know, the trial court and again repeated in our briefs, those are necessary to evaluate not just for damages. It is also to determine if there's liability. And then they also come into play, at least some of them, right, to determine if there was an injury, and if so, how can you reasonably calculate what that compensation, if any, should be. So, again, that was the only one that's comparable in that regard. Again, I think I just wanted to point out, and I believe Your Honor, Judge Goss mentioned this in a question to appellant's counsel, is that, again, there seems to be an incomplete and abbreviated view by appellant of what is required to establish this claim. It is not that there is an automatic liability attachment and some kind of harm, albeit maybe measured differently from a dollar's standpoint, that it automatically attaches simply by the fact that they were published. They don't cite support for that. There isn't any support for that. And in fact, the trial court judge did not make this determination, nor have we advanced it in our papers, which is that the reason that there's no class certification appropriate here is because the damage amounts might be different. You won't find that in the trial court's ruling, nor in our papers. That's not the position as to why class certification is not appropriate. The reason it is not is because appellants were not able to satisfy the commonality and typicality requirements under 23A and then under 23B. They likewise, for basically the same reasons, aren't able to establish that there's a predominance or a superiority demonstration here in order to have a class certification for this particular claim in this situation.
Do you think it would be possible, and there was some mention of subclasses here, and I know it was in a slightly different context, but that there's some theoretical possibility of subclasses of, I don't know, people with otherwise spotless records, for example, who were upstanding members of their communities whose charges were eventually dropped or didn't proceed for some reason. Like, would that be possible, or does that get, do you think that would still run into problems either under Rule 23 or with the elements of the false light tort?
I think it runs into issues with both, but also just imagining the effort to try to comb through tens of thousands of people's history, records, court records, backgrounds, et cetera, to try to carve out these what could be, what, hundreds of subclasses, that certainly weighs strongly against the 23B3 factor, right? Superiority of handling it that way. But it definitely, again, there isn't just one thing. It's one plaintiff taken at who he is or she is or they are, and what is that person's situation. History, background, current crimes, current charges, prior convictions, all of those things that you mentioned, Judge Gayona, in this restatement section comment, and that Judge Fox also pointed out in his ruling, which is, are there major misrepresentations about that person and their ability, character, history, et cetera? There just simply is no way, even with what sounds like could possibly be hundreds of subclasses, to remedy that for purposes of meeting the requirements, the prerequisite requirements for a Rule 23 class certification.
Discovery came up, and I understand that the request came rather late here at our court. But could they potentially cure it if they were given a chance to do some discovery? And if not, why not?
The answer is no, and here's why. Appellants haven't presented to you any specific discovery that's going to solve their problems under the commonality, typicality, predominance, and superiority elements of the rule to allow them to demonstrate that they can meet those prerequisites for class certification. They talk about the crime type. They talk about the the fact that the disclaimer wasn't there. They talk about, you know, whatever other private information was there, and that they should be able to have discovery into those policies. Again, as you pointed out, Judge Foster, I believe, during the questioning, that policy is not relevant to the inquiry here for purposes of this particular tort and certification under Rule 23. It is the fact that they'd have to come to you and present to you, and they should have done it at the trial court below, so we maintain our position that they have waived that request or that form of relief on appeal here, but they'd have to demonstrate that there's discovery available to them that could help them satisfy any number of one of these requirements. The footnote that you mentioned, Judge Goss, I think, I'm sorry, sure. Judge Gaona, my apologies.
Give credit where it's due.
Yep, the footnote that you mentioned also really focuses on numerosity, which again, the trial court said, fine, you meet numerosity. While we challenged it initially, the trial court judge sided with them. And in fact, any discovery about numerosity then is irrelevant, right? Because we're not challenging that, or it's not being challenged as of right now. But they haven't presented any proposed discovery that's going to carry the day for them from a commonality, typicality, predominance, and superiority standpoint. It is not in the papers, and I don't think you'll hear it in argument. We certainly haven't heard it.
Would you agree with me, Ms. Barnes, that if we were to affirm the trial court's ruling, that ruling would not say anything about the merits of Mr. Houston's claims or any other putative class members' claims?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. There's no such argument.
And the reason I say that, and again, I keep going back to the restatement on this, you know, there's an illustration, I think it's illustration 7, that talks about rogues galleries. And there's a lot of mention of this in the plaintiff's briefings, and one of the illustrations, that illustration talks about, rather, a person who's included in a rogues gallery, and even though they were never convicted of a crime and they were falsely accused, and they were included in there, and it says that in that case, there was an invasion of privacy. So I just want to be clear here, and thank you for answering my question there, that there are folks out there who may have valid claims. The narrow issue that we are grappling with here is whether a class action is a proper vehicle by which to resolve those claims.
We agree, Your Honor, but also I just want to point out that, again, when you referenced that illustration, you mentioned being falsely accused and put in a rogue gallery with others.
Sure.
We don't have that here, right? They're not disputing that the information posted is accurate. So you go to that second prong of the inquiry under the false light invasion of tort, those elements. It has to be, if it's true, then you have to meet all of these other requirements, which they did not meet, and the trial judge properly ruled. The fact that appellant repeatedly says that there was error does not mean error occurred. And again, our position is that there is no credible legal support that they have pointed this court to, or the trial court below for that matter, that warrants a finding that Judge Fox, the trial court, should be overruled. There was no abuse of discretion, no clear error of law, and the detailed opinion that was issued provides ample support for why there was a denial of certification upon plaintiff's motion for class certification at the stage they so chose. So we respectfully request that this court affirm the ruling below and not grant any kind of other relief.
Just one final question before you sit down. I know there was a stipulation below to stay one of the state law claims pending the outcome of the appeal in the federal action. Obviously, the federal action is, I think, now back. What's the status of the federal action? And is, you know, even if we were to agree with you, is this case going to come back to us? Are we going to have another round of this on this other state law claim that has not been adjudicated between the parties?
My view of that is no, and that an appeal, if the substantive due process claim under the state constitution, that's the remaining claim that's been stayed. And because that claim on a federal level is now back in the trial court, at the federal court, in the federal court matter, our belief is that the substantive due process claim under the Arizona Constitution in this case is unnecessary, despite the fact that we disagree that there's a valid legal support to pursue it as a private remedy. So I don't believe that there's a real risk of that, and the federal case is now moving along through discovery, and just try to think if there's, yeah, we're just in the middle of discovery in that case, and there have been some preliminary rulings about various issues, but we believe that that is the place to adjudicate that type of constitutional claim, and that this case should be simply proceed to an end with respect to the false light invasion of privacy tort.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honors.
So let's give appellant a minute and a half. Counsel, why don't you wait until they get the clock set for you? When you're ready.
William Wagner on behalf of the plaintiff. I just wanted to hop on to what Judge Gayana had asked just about the status of the federal case. It is indeed proceeding through discovery, and I think that that goes to one of the other questions that was asked, which is what sort of information could be gleaned through further discovery in this case if remanded back for discovery. There we have presented an expert that has presented a model for measuring class-wide reputational harm. We have presented an expert who has presented a method for calculating class-wide damages attributable to that reputational harm that is measurable for every class member. We believe that if that were able to be asserted throughout discovery and presented to the trial court down below, it may in fact change his rulings, because despite Ms. Barnes' argument that the trial court never made a finding as to the damages being so disparate, the court in its order said, as defendants point out, there simply is no reliable method to calculate damages in a uniform way. And it decided based on that, that there was no predominance. Those sorts of issues that can be determined through discovery, if remanded, can in fact impact that very determination. And we believe will show that there are in fact no individualized inquiries that would prevent class certification. Unless there are other questions, I'll leave it at that.
I think you're at your time. So
thank you, Your Honors.
We will take the matter under advisement. We appreciate counsel being here. We appreciate that you were well prepared for argument and focusing your argument. We will issue our ruling in due course. Oh, that's right. I am used to courtroom too, I guess.